Try to keep in mind that for some, this may be the first exposure in some time to the Masechet of Bava Kamma. We are now going to begin the third parak, which is found on the Chav Zayin, and we will begin with the Mishnah tonight, which, as we're going to see in a moment, while it does begin to introduce us to some specific laws of hezek, of damages, our discussion tonight and perhaps for the next few weeks is not going to relate specifically to the meat of the Mishnah, as we will see. The Mishnah begins by talking about somebody who is walking through the shuk, and he places his kad, his pitcher, down on the ground. He places a pitcher of water, let's say, on the ground, in a public place, and then someone else comes along, and apparently, inadvertently, stumbles upon it, trips on it, and then shvara, it breaks, and the question now is he obligated to pay for the damage? So the Mishnah rules that the one who tripped on this barrel, on this pitcher, is going to be pater. Why is he going to be pater? After all, there's a principle that we've been learning again and again and again and again, called Adamu Leolam, Bein Ba'onet, Bein Baratzon, Bein Besogig, Bein Mezid, meaning a human being is responsible for his actions. Whether he realizes it or not, it doesn't matter. See, here you have a person walking in the street, and he kicks somebody's pitcher and it breaks. So why should he be putter? Why should he be putter? So pashtus is, because the person who placed the card down had no business putting it down in the middle of the street. He should have realized that's not a place to put it. So even though someone else technically broke it, he was negligent with his own property, and therefore the one who kicks it is going to be putter. What happens if this person who tripped on it, says Rashi Haniskal, the person who trips on it, he gets damaged. Let's say the pieces, the shards of the pitcher, they hurt him, or he trips on it. So then what's the din? So then the din is that the balachavis is chayv b'nizko. Then the person who placed the pitcher down, so he's going to be obligated to pay for the damage which happened to the one who tripped over it. So not only is the niskal, the one who trips, not obligated to pay for the damage which was done to the property, but if he was damaged in the process, then he's going to be chayv, then the balachavis is going to be chayv to pay. Okay, so pretty straightforward. If you have any questions, you can ask, but so far this seems to make sense. And Rashi reminds us twice in his very short commentary on the Mishnah that the Gemara is going to explain everything. And we know that when Rashi does that, he means to say that there are new principles that are going to be introduced over here. This is not a simple continuation of everything we learned beforehand. So it's not like Rashi can give you a one or two line. No, Rashi says you have to wait to the Gemara to understand what operating principles are basically driving the conclusions of this Mishnah. But one thing is clear, and that is that the person who places his own pitcher down on the street, so he is responsible for the damage which occurs to his pitcher, and even for the damage which may happen to the person who trips.
The size at this point doesn't make a difference.
The size doesn't make a difference, right. Why would you say that? It's interesting. You'll see in a moment why I asked that. But at this point, apparently there is no difference whether it's a small pitcher or a large pitcher. And in fact, we're going to see in the Gemara in a moment that the Gemara does mention that. There is, in addition to the two Rashis, which say Mefarish for Gemara, there is one interesting Rashi on the Mishnah, which Rashi says a one-word commentary. You see, Rashi Ibn Maskudin, who's Agba? Rashi says, and if he was damaged, so what does Rashi say of him? Who's Agba? What does Rashi say over there? One word, haniskal. Meaning that if he was damaged, the one who trips, so then, what? The Baal HaChavis is going to be chayv to pay.
I hope I pushed the right button, though. I just want to make sure. It's definitely one of
this. It's getting cooler? Okay, good. All right, good. All right, so let's just leave it for a minute or so and see if it continues to feel cooler. Obviously, and I know that this is not an introduction to learning for anyone here, so everybody appreciates and understands that every comment that Rashi makes has extreme significance, and nothing should be just passed by and taken for granted. So Rashi says over here, who gets damaged? The niskal. So what is Rashi getting at over there? Why does Rashi have to say that? After all, let's just take a picture in mind. I'm walking down the street, I put my pitcher on the ground. Someone walks into it and it breaks in lots of pieces. And now, someone gets hurt. who gets hurt? So there could be three people that got hurt. And any one of three people. Who?
The tripper.
I'm sorry, the tripper, or?
The person who put it there,
or? Or someone else. But Rashi over here is clearly saying that who gets hurt? The niskal. The one who tripped. As opposed to, as you may think, the balachavis, or you may have thought someone else. So what's driving Rashi's payrish over here? Why does Rashi assume? And over here Rashi doesn't say kumafarish begumar, because Gemara is not going to state this explicitly, although it probably does come out, it certainly does come out of the sugi, the way the sugi progresses. Yeah.
But if we said it was a third party, I mean, if it was the person who put the cod there, then it would be no point in mentioning it. The guy put a cod there, and he ends up getting hurt by putting it there, and he's responsible to himself. What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything.
Oh.
But it could be that the stander by who got hurt. And then we can say, oh, the stander by got hurt. Maybe the person who put the cod there has to pay for it.
Right.
But if it's the person who tripped, we'd say, oh, he did it.
Oh.
He caused it. It wasn't broken until he came along. So by saying that the person who caused it,
it's a chiddush,
and gets hurt by it, that, so therefore, not only the person who's standing by didn't do anything,
but even in this column,
the guy who causes it,
right,
still doesn't have to pay.
Excellent.
Still the owner of,
or is entitled to damages.
And gets damages.
Is entitled to damages, right. So I agree with half of what you said. The second half, I was going to show you, but...
Does it exempt the third person?
Oh, so no, it'll be a kal v'chomer. Take a look at the sheet that I gave out to you. So at the second source on the page, source number two, I didn't actually have the Sefer Nachlas Yisrael, but I saw that the pshat that was just suggested, quoted by the Sefer Osam Mefarshei HaTalmud, and they quote the Nachlas Yisrael. I don't know if this is an exact quote, but this is basically what he claims Nachlas Yisrael writes. The Havamina that one could have thought, the Dafkon who's Akbaadim Acher Chayiv Balachavish. That only if a third person gets hurt, so then the Balachavish is Chayiv to pay. Aval Nizkal Atzmo Huzak, but if the tripper, the guy who breaks it, he himself gets Pata, if he himself gets hurt, then maybe the Balachavish would be Pata. Why? Because Kevin, the self, Nizbar Machmasel, look, he broke it. So even though, yes, he's not responsible to pay for the broken pitcher, but if he tripped and broke the pitcher, and in the process gets hurt, so I don't have to pay for that. So Kamash Balan comes along Rashi and teaches, no, even the Niskal, and included in that certainly would be Adam Acher. But you started off by saying that it's a Davar Pashit, it's absolutely clear that the Balachavish himself was not the one who got hurt, because one gets to tell me he doesn't pay himself, right. But the reason why you said that is because you were reading the Mishnah a certain way. You were reading the Mishnah the way that I read it, and perhaps... if you would have been reading this the first time, you could have read the Mishnah a little differently. Remember, there's no punctuation in the Mishnah. So read the Mishnah again. Watch this. Hamineach hatakad versus a rabbin. Someone places a pitcher in the street. Ubaachar v'niskabah. Someone else comes along, trips on it, and it breaks. He's potter. V'muhuzak v'balachavis. And if the balachavis, what? Gets hurt? So then chayiv b'nizko, then he's chayiv to pay. Now that may still seem like a far out pshat to you, but it's no longer... That you perhaps could have thought that the guy who kicked it and broke it is now chayav to pay for the damages that the balachavis incurred. So Rashi is teaching you, don't read the Mishnah that way. Rashi is saying that it's an incorrect reading of the Mishnah, and the Pnei Yeshua learns this way. If you look at the first source on the page I gave you, the Pnei Yeshua writes, Peirush Rashi, from Huzak Ba, says Rashi, Aniskal. Who got hurt? The one who tripped. So says Bnei Yeshua, Kavanaso Lefarish, Rashi is intending to explain, Shalom Lefarish Huzak Balachavish B'charasim, that it's not that the Balachavish is the one who got hurt on the shards. The Chayiv HaNiskal, and therefore the one who tripped is Chayiv to pay. Shahayil Olesalek Shvorm, because after all, once you broke it immediately, you should have removed the pieces. V'hadunaka Huzak Balachavish, and why would, if that would be the pshat, so why would the Balachavish be singled out? More so than anyone else, perhaps you would have thought that even the Balachavish, even though he started this whole mess by putting it down in the first place, you would have thought that maybe the Mishnah is saying he is now entitled to damages. So therefore, the lesson of the high perusha, no, Ela Niskal. It's clearly Rashi didn't make this up. That's the way that the sugya is going to go on to explain the circumstances anyway. Teishu doesn't say explicitly what I said in terms of reading Mishnah, but it must be that that's what he means. Because otherwise it says, the way we're reading the Mishnah, it says the Balachavis is chayiv to pay. So there would have been no havamina to say the Balachavis is chayiv to pay himself. So I suppose what the Teishu means is that you could read the Mishnah, and who's Akwa Balachavis? So then, Chayiv Benisko, then perhaps you would have thought that the Niskal is Chayiv to pay it. Okay.
The first thing you said from the Knock of Israel, which doesn't really make sense, is looking at that you would have thought that if someone else had that, a third party, right?
Right.
That the Baal Chavis would be Chayiv, but if the one who tripped on it got hurt, he'd be puzzled.
Right.
Why, and then he said, but, and then he said that the Baal Chavis, they see in the end that he'd be chayiv whether it's the one who tripped on it or a third party. Right. Logically, I mean, the first, the hum, you know, why is that? It doesn't really make sense, because if you're going to say that the third person, if it hit the third person, he would be chayiv, but not the guy who tripped on it. Why would that be different? Because if it's the guy's fault for tripping on it, and that's why he doesn't have to pay him, that's why he's part of him. So that means that for a third party, it should be the guy who tripped on his fault also. And it shouldn't change who's at fault depending on who got hurt.
No, not necessarily.
Who's at fault for the fact that it broke.
Why was that?
Mm-hmm. That shot, what we're looking for, would seem to say that the person who tripped on it, broke it, has to assume some culpability. Whereas the third party, which is a bystander, was simply a bystander, he didn't have it.
Right. As far as the pitcher is concerned, so the Mishnah Paskins, that despite the fact someone else broke it, to borrow an expression that we used elsewhere, I'm not sure that it's appropriate exactly here, but like Haim Garmelo, that the owner of the pitcher, he's responsible because of the way he put it. But in terms, not what I'm saying, but in terms of the right, so I hear what you're saying. So Mimarav Shach, if tripping over that is something which is considered...
I'm not saying that you should have to pay for the pitcher.
No, I understand.
I think the guy who tripped on it should have to pay for the damage to the third party.
So what it says over here is Kevin Sof Nishbra Machmasog, since it was his fault, then maybe he should somehow share in the damages to some extent. And it's not enough that he doesn't have to pay for the pitcher, but that he should then go ahead and be able to sue the Baal HaChavis. No, because after all, you shouldn't walk around the street with your eyes closed either. So maybe it's almost like a compromise. Okay, I hear what you're saying. It all comes down to this expression, Kevin the Sof Nishbarach Mamasor, and it's not clear what exactly that means. The Gemara now begins by making a very, very technical observation, which does not really get into the meat and potatoes of the Mishnah itself, which is why I said that even tonight, and perhaps sometimes as well, we're not really going to discuss the actual details within this Mishnah. But the Gemara begins by talking about a very, very technical point, which is, Lenny, when you said before, does it matter what the size of the kad is? So the reason why that's interesting is because the Gemara observes, and I don't know how many other people, if you've never learned this, if you've learned the parak before, so maybe it's back in your mind, but if you never learned this before, I wonder if you picked up on the following. The Gemara says, it's very strange. Pasach b'kad, tisayim b'chavis. What does that mean? It's not a long Mishnah. It's only three lines here. But right in front of our eyes, the Mishnah changes the word which is used to describe that which was placed on the ground. First, the Mishnah calls it a kad, which means a pitcher. And then the Mishnah, right in front of our eyes, called it a chavis. We're talking about the very, very same object. That's clear. There was a kad and then there was a chavis. No, it's the same thing. And the fact that Gemara's go on to say, it's really the same thing. But it seems somewhat odd, somewhat strange, that the same object would be described using two different words in the very same Mishnah. So the Gemara says, Pasach b'kad, shein b'chavis. That's very strange. And the Gemara goes on to say, this is not the only time that we find this phenomenon. Tnanami, we have a Mishnah later on, which is going to do the same. It says, Zeh baba chaviso. This guy is walking with his pitcher. A chavis will translate more accurately as a barrel. Vizeh baba karaso. And this guy's walking with his bean. Right? It's like the old commercial, this guy's walking with his chocolate, he's walking with peanut butter, and what happens? Boom, they hit each other. So what happens? Nishbrakado shazeh b'karasho zoseh. The guy with the beam knocks, they hit each other. And the beam doesn't break, obviously, but the barrel does. So then the din is that the balakora, the guy holding the beam, is potter. Why? So this, we're going to have to wait till we see. But here is what we see, because basically both of them had the right to do that which they were doing. And there is just a rabbi. You have the right to carry certain types of loads, and this was all within what was a considered acceptable, reasonable, and therefore he's not obligated to pay for the damage which was done. But here as well, we find that Pasach Mechadis, the same Bekai, here it's swart, here it's reversed. But the idea is the same, that the Mishnah uses two descriptions of the very same object. And the Gemara says, we find it yet again. You find it later on in the Masechta, Usnanami Zeba Bechaviso Shel Yayin. There's a one guy who's walking with his, he has a barrel of wine. The Zeba Bechago Shel Devash. And this guy is holding a pitcher of honey. Now, they do not bump into each other, and neither of them damage each other. But what happens is, Nizbika Chavish El Devash, the guy who was holding a pitcher of honey, so what happened was it cracked. It was his tough luck. Maybe he dropped it, or maybe it was break. But it breaks. So what happens is, he's standing there, and he's watching all of his honey fall to the ground. So the other guy who was holding a barrel full of wine, what does he do? Shavach Zeyeno. He spills out his wine. Why does he do that? He's a nice guy. So Rashi points out that the vash, the honey, is much more valuable than the wine. So he says, I'll do the guy a favor, or maybe I'll profit from the whole thing. He pours out his wine, and he quickly, the hitzilas advash, he rescues whatever honey hasn't spilled on the floor. So the Mishnah of the Apashkins, interesting deal, although we're going to have to wait many, many, many years before we see this, ein lo ela scharo. All he can do is sue him for what? Not use the word sue. All he can do is claim the schar. Says Rashi, what's the schar? Kishar poel. He has the right to charge him what a person would charge a worker for doing work for him. The ein balad vash mishalim dmei hayayin. But the guy who is holding, the owner of the honey, does not have to pay him for his wine that he spilled out on the floor. Even though I only spilled out my wine to help you, you didn't ask. You should have asked me first. I would have told you don't bother doing that. You spilled out your own wine. I don't have to pay you for that. I do have to pay you whatever is considered a reasonable wage for the service that you offered me. But here as well, without, again, focusing at all, and it's tempting, but we're not going to do it, without focusing on the specifics of that case, here as well you see, says the Gemara, the first wide line, Pasach Bekad Sayin Bechavis. The same phenomena that we find that the same object is described using two different words. No, it is, because watch. It said, I knew someone who was going to do that. No, because watch what happened. Go back. Zeba b'chaviso shel yayin, zeba b'kado shel dvash, and then it says, nizuga chavish shel dvash. Right? So the one holding the honey is called first the kado, then the chavish. So what is going on over here? It didn't just happen once, twice, three times. We find this strange phenomenon, the same word is used. So Rav Papa says the following. Papa says, no problem. Hainu kad, hainu chavis. It's really the same thing. It's really, really the same thing. And therefore, therefore what? There's no difference. Therefore, there's no difference. So l'may nafkamina. So what does l'may nafkamina mean?
Why is the Mishnah bothering to use this switching language?
Right. So that's what I would have said. That's what I...
The last point of view was the difference.
Right. So I understand. So I would have said, I would have learned that way, but there are some Rishonim that learn Lamayin Afkamin a little differently. Why? And there are some Rishonim that say exactly as you just said, but some learn it differently because... just take a look very quickly. Before we see the answer, it's just interesting. The Rashba writes in source number 3, Lamayin Afkamin, Mekach Mekach, so don't even... Just ignore those two words because we haven't seen them yet in the Gemara. So he asks, Kashali. He says, I don't understand. Ulashminan hai tana hai dina. That if the Tana is really coming to teach us this din, and we're going to learn that din in a moment, but wants to teach us that really Kad and Chavis are really the same. So lamali kol hani masnisin. Why do you need three examples? Ulashminan chadazinna. Just teach me once and that's sufficient. Umistavid masnisin lav lashminan hai dina. So therefore, the way he understands the sugya is that the Mishnah is not teaching you this. Rather, the Mishnah is just talking normally. When the Gemara asks, what's the difference? It's asking, why do you care? It's asking, why did the Gemara take, I mean, it's strange because it's been the Gemara itself, but the Chazal, in the beginning of the sugi, begin to observe sometimes Kad, sometimes Chavish, and then Rav Papa says at the end of the day it's the same thing. So the Gemara says, well, why did you even ask the question in the first place? Who really cares? Why does it matter what he called? So now what does the Gemara answer? So the Gemara says the Nafkamina is Lemekach Umemkar. Lemekach Umemkar. What does Mekach Umemkar mean? That's a halach expression which is used to mean what? Business for the purpose of sales. What does it mean for the purpose of sales? So I'll tell you outside and then we'll look at Rashi very simply. If we have an arrangement that you walk into my store, you're looking around, and you say, I'd like to buy a kad. Or, excuse me, you say, I'd like to buy a chavis. Say, I'd like to buy a chavis. I say, no problem. And I tell you that the chavis is going to cost you $10. And we agree on a price. And then I go into the back and I give you a kad. Right? You asked for a barrel. You expect from chavis. I said, no problem. We agreed on a price. And then I bring you a pitcher. So the din is that even though we agreed on a price and you had in mind a what? A chavish, the din is that I, the mocher, can insist that you must take this kad. Because after all, I know how. That's what the Papa says. It's really the same thing. Says Rashi, Shebiyad ha-mocher lo-seis lo-izash yitza. The seller has a right to give to the buyer whatever he wants. Vafilu hisnim al-chavish. And even if they agreed on a chavish, the mashma gedola, which, yes, has that implication of being a bigger keli. Nevertheless, losin lo kad shi katani. Still has the right to give him the smaller pitcher, because and that happens to be smaller, because when all is said and done, chavis and kad, those words really mean the same things. They're used interchangeably. Doesn't make sense. What don't you like about it? Go ahead. No, we didn't say that. If you point say, I want that one, so that's something else completely different. But he says, walks in and says, I'd like to look around, I said, I'd like a chavis. Go ahead.
If you don't show what it is you're giving for the $10 before, you only show it afterwards.
Well, then you shouldn't agree to purchase something before you see it. The lokeach has a right to say, I want to see the merchandise before I agree to pay for it. But if he's already agreed to pay for it, or if he already paid for it, he says, here's the $10, the guy goes in the back and he brings him out a kad, he says, what we agreed on. We agreed on a chavis, and this is a chavis. It's the same thing. I know it doesn't seem fair. Granted, it doesn't seem fair, but when all is said and done, sometimes business is business, and you have to think before you say something. And again, but just to make it clear, if he points to this, then there's no question.
You're also saying something that's somewhat contradictory.
Go ahead.
Because at the one hand, you're saying that chavis implies something larger
right.
than a barrel. And on the other hand, you're saying that they're interchangeable.
Right.
Both shouldn't be true.
Right. So the Gemara sort of asked that question. The Gemara says, wait a second. Hey, Chidami, what's going on over here? Ilema, if we're talking about a case, Bahasa de Kada lo kari chavis, if we're talking about a place where people just don't call a kada chavis, meaning what? I think that's what it means. People know a kada is small and a chavis is large. If that's what we're talking about, the chavis lo kari kada, and people do not call a chavis a kada, so halo kari lo. So how could you do that to the guy? That's not what it's called in this particular place. So the Gemara says, you're right, the Gemara says. If you're talking about a place where everybody calls a kad, and everybody calls a chavis, then you can't pull the shtick, even though you know the Gemara above a kad of chavzayim. No. So what is it? Well, tzricha, we're talking about a case that what? The ruba karu la kada kada, l'chavisa chavisa. Most people use the specific terminology. They'll call a kad and a chavis. The economic decorum of chavis, the kada, the kada chavis. However, it's not unusual, it's not unheard of that people use them interchangeably. So mao de tema, here's the punchline of the whole sugi. I would have thought, well, what do you do? Zil basa ruba. You follow the majority, right? What do the majority do? The majority say chavis is a chavis, kada kad. So kamash v'lan comes along this sugi and teaches, as we found other places in Shas as well, be'ein hochin b'mamo nacha arov. Then when it comes to monetary issues, we're not interested in the rov. We don't care what most people do. Yes, it's true that most people in Tinek call a chavis and a kad a kad, but there are some who say a chavis is a kad and a kad is a chavis, and therefore if you walk into a store and you say, I'd like a chavis, and you put $10 down, and he comes out with a kad, So the Gemara paskins, he has a right to give that to you. After all, there are those, bless you, there are those who do call a kara chavis, and the store owner has a right to say, I'm one of those people. I'm one of those people that say a kara is a chavis. Why? Because ein holchim b'mamon acharov. And this is, again, when I said before that we're going to talk about it for a few weeks, I don't know how many weeks, I can just tell you, and I mean this without exaggeration, that there is enough material out there to discuss this sugya, including two tosos right here, probably a year. I'm just saying, just in terms of what the indexes provide, now, I don't know, I'm just saying, it's out there. So there's so much that can be discussed. So if you feel that there are these concerns that are flying out in your head, you know, you're in good company. I mean, literally pages and pages, and just in indexes alone of sources to look at for this. We won't do that, but we're certainly not going to walk away from this in a second. Yeah. Did you want to say something?
I was just going to say, how do we quantify the rove? Let's say, is it 51 to 49, then that's okay.
Right, so in general, when it comes to rove in Shas, that's a very good question. Generally assume that, if I'm not mistaken, I heard Rav Shechter say on a number of occasions that 10% is considered a meal, meaning 90% is rov, the 10% is a meal. Less than that already is what Chazal called a miyuta de miyuta. It's a very, very small percentage, and that already we wouldn't necessarily say is considered like a regular meal. So when we follow rov, so we generally say that rov is obviously anywhere from 51%, maybe even to as much as 90%. I think that's the way the Chassam Sofer formulated it. It's not absolutely clear, but it could be that if there's something which is an overwhelming rov, that it's like 99% at once, so then we wouldn't necessarily say this. But we're talking over here, maybe it's 60-40, 75-25, we'll work with a number like that. But it's clearly the majority calls a chavis and a karakai. I'm convinced now that the air conditioning is not on, but I don't know if there's anything to do about it, but it doesn't take this long.
It's so bad, but
if we can. I may have touched the wrong thing. But, did somebody want to say something? Yeah.
So, how does the Rajba answer his question? I mean, why do we need four Mishnahs that use the word?
So the reason why the Tanam uses interchangeably is just because that's kiyachin nakan. That's normal. I mean, it's
that doesn't make sense. If you say that it's in a place where in fact it's like peel and buck,
right?
It doesn't really make a difference.
Right.
Okay, then you can understand. You start saying peel and then you should bucket. It's a big difference, right? But Gemara in fact tells us that's not the case. Most people, in fact, use the word bucket, and they don't use bucket, pay something else for that.
Right.
But, okay, there are some people, who use the reverse. So, this guy is, the Tana is,
No, obviously the Tanoim over here, obviously, it seems to me that even the Rashba is going to agree that there was a deliberate plant over here, that they were specifically saying, Kar Chavis, to teach us or to demonstrate to us that they are the same. But when the Gemara asked Lamai Nafkamina, it wasn't saying why did the Tanoim do that, because then, as the Rashba said, it could have just done it once. Rather, the Rashba said, why did the Gemara take the time to point this out? Obviously,
I understand that.
Right?
I'm saying we still have a question. Why do you have the Tanoim saying in four different places?
So the Mekab, Elchanami, right, so...
I think that supports the concept of the orcha, orcha.
Right.
By showing you numerous examples, I demonstrate that this is a style of Mishnah expression. One example wouldn't have demonstrated that as well. But look, it's all over the Mishnah. It's all over the parable.
That, in fact, would suggest to me that, in fact, there is no distinction at all. But the Gemara doesn't seem to go that way. It seems to be learning a second principle. Not that in language, Kaz means Kaz, but that, Kaz and Kaz really are separate things, like 75% of people use them in 15 days, 75% don't, and we go according to we don't go according to Ruba and Mamona. That's a different principle from saying, they're really the same thing. That, I think, that would be easy to understand why you have several Mishnah that are using this mixture of words.
The purpose of using the two expressions was to demonstrate the rule that in doing business in this area, you will not be able to sue for one term over the other, because there are enough people who use it interchangeably that you won't have anything to stand on. And how do we see that? Because we see that the Gemara went, the Mishnah went out of its way to use it multiple times.
Let's leave it at that for now, on this point. Yeah.
Wouldn't there be another train of thought saying, being that the Mishnah used it differently so many times, obviously there's a difference between them, and don't assume that they're the same?
Well, if the Mishnah is using it to describe the very same object, right, it says, I put my cot on the street, and then somebody kicks my chavish, and it's the very same object, so then it seems clear that these words are...
Then you could say, okay, it's not, if they would have used a cot every single time, I would think to myself, oh, okay, so you're talking about a small picture.
No, but how could you say they're different if the very same object is described using two different words? It's the same object. And this one in the Mishnah uses cot and chavish to describe it.
We're saying it's the same object. But what if we're saying, no, they're giving us examples of an object. So in other words, we could start off the story that it started off as a pitcher, or we could end off as a barrel.
But it's the same story.
That it could be either a pitcher or a barrel.
But if you're describing one specific scenario, if there were three cases in the Mishnah, let's say, so then that would be actually a very common type of, you know, style that you would find in the Mishnah, different examples. But when you're talking about the very same case, or over here, one guy's walking with his coat and one guy's walking with his chavis, and then his cot breaks, I mean, it's literally, you know, it's the same story. So then it's hard to come to the conclusion that they are dafka separate. Now again, they are separate, as Avi said before, I was contradicting myself, but clearly the mashmas, the implication is that a kata is something which is smaller than a chavis. And no one is denying that. No one is denying that. The point is that they are similar enough, or more importantly, the way people speak is that these words are sometimes used interchangeably. After all, some people say pitcher, a jar, a barrel, a jug, even in English. Some of these words, I mean, what is the difference between a pitcher and a jug? Is there a difference? I understand, but that doesn't mean that the common man is aware of that and speaks that way. So when the average person on the street says pitcher, or says jug, or says barrel, so he may not necessarily have in mind what you do. But clearly there is a difference, otherwise there wouldn't be a separate word. So the Gemara concludes that ultimately, halakhically, they are... that we consider these terms to be similar enough so that in a situation where there is a dispute, so we would say that we would not follow the majority, which is really an independent principle. It's really an independent principle. And even in the place where you have a majority of people that speak one way, nevertheless, the mocher, or as Tosfos is going to say, the reverse would be true as well, the lokeach has a right to say, well, this is what I had in mind and not what you had in mind. Okay, so that's the idea of Ein Holchin, the Mamon Acharov, that we did not follow the majority. And I just wanted, because this is something we're going to be discussing more in a moment, but in general, if this is a new concept, so it's one that you should begin to just think about the implications of it, because it is a very, very profound concept. In fact, I'm ashamed to admit this publicly, but I will, that about 6 or 7 years ago, well, actually, I'm not ashamed, because I was called for jury duty in the middle of the year. And I, being the, I thought, the shamely person I am, I didn't want to have to miss year. So I decided to postpone jury duty until after school, the week before spring camp started. So I got called exactly when I scheduled it for, and I sat there for 3 days, and we're getting closer and closer to camp. And I was running the chinuch staff. I was a very important person at camp. And then I got called, in the city, you have to sit there for 5 days. I got called, and I got selected the last day to sit on a trial that they said would last approximately 2 weeks. So I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. It was an interesting, I still remember the janitor slipped in the World Trade Center, in the basement, and he was suing the World Trade Center. So I got selected. And I was panicked. I didn't know what I was going to do, because nobody called my name all week. I was just sitting there. So, I didn't know what to do. So I remember that I ultimately weaseled my way out. But what I told them was that, and I tried to do this in a way not to make a chasham, I said, listen, I am a teacher of Talmud, and I happened to be that year I was teaching Bava Kama. Your son was my shir that year. I was teaching Bava Kama. I said, I'm so focused on the Jewish monetary laws. I'm not going to be able to just go ahead. And they said, no, we'll tell you the law. I said, no, you don't understand. It's not, you know, and then they, so I'll never forget, one of the lawyers was not a Jew, says, what do you mean? And my boss is an Orthodox Jew, and he always tells me the reason why he's such a great attorney is because he learns Talmud. So he said, tell me one difference. Tell me, what is the difference? Now he made, so I told him, oh, I said, there's a principle by us that ain't holchem b'mamon achar roz. That I know, I'm not an expert in civil law, but I know there's a concept of, proving something beyond, reasonable doubt. In Jewish law, when it comes to monetary issues, that's not good enough. You can't prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. You need absolute proof. Hamotzi mechaveiro l'avarayu. You want to take something from me, you want my money, you have to prove absolutely that it's yours, and anything short of that is not good enough. They weren't impressed because they said, well, in the end, I was called into the inner chambers, and they agreed that if I would ever be called back again, I would be called to criminal court. And then I moved out of the city, so I was never called again. But I told them I never learned Sanhedrin, and it wouldn't be an issue. And they put you back, and you don't get called for 3 years. In the end, I think we all left on good terms, but it was an uncomfortable situation. But I remember telling them this, Ein holchem b'mamon achar roz. It's a chiddush, because again, we're going to begin to see how far this concept goes. You really have to be absolutely certain in order to take someone else's possession, someone else's money. So again, the scenario over here is the money, let's say, has been given. The lokeach has given his money to the mocheh. Now the mocheh has given him a kad. This is what you purchase. Now you want my chavis? You want me to take back my kad and give you my chavis? You have to prove. You have to prove that this is yours. What's your proof? Your proof is that you use the word chavis, go next door and go there, and I could give you a list of 10 people on this block that do not call a chavis what you call a chavis. They call a chavis a kad. And so therefore, ein holchem b'mamon achar roz. That's the like Izzy said, point to it. What do you say? It's got to be these dimensions.
So I just want to understand. So you defined robe as like 90% of the people?
Right.
So the Gemara
says, as much as, we'll say, at least. That's
the Gemara is saying that 90% of the people, that robe people, understand there's a differentiation between kad and chavis.
Right.
And yet they're stipulating that because 10% of the people don't understand that
though.
Right. There's an ignorance
there. Right. I don't know if
it's
ignorance. Again, we're not going to... No, you have to understand. We're not going to give the mocha... We're not going to give him this time. It's not like we're going to... Obviously, the mocha over here, why is this dispute even being discussed? Why does this case come to Beis Din? It comes to Beis Din because the mocha is insisting, that's what I call a chavis. That when you ask me chavis, that's what I think. So you want to prove that that's not me, that that's not so. Well, you have to prove that. And if you can't prove that, so ain't holchem b'mamon achar roz.
You have to prove it is conceived of a problem. I mean, 90% of people understand
that it's ignorant. That's what I told him when I tried to get into jury duty. Exactly that this is such an unbelievable chiddush, that a reasonable doubt is not enough. You want my money, you have to prove that it's yours. And anything short of that is not enough, is not sufficient. Well, it's not a question of what to say. It's a question is Dina Mamun, I'm a mukhsa, this is my money, this is my barrel. You want it, you have to prove that it's yours. You have not proven sufficiently that it's yours. I mean, I'm not saying it's logical. I'm not saying it's illogical, because I don't know if we're going to see it. I want to, but we'll see someone tonight who says it absolutely is logical. But even if you think it's illogical, it doesn't matter per se at this point. Because now again, there is a machlokes between Rav and Shmuel, well, in fact, ain't holchem b'mamon achar roz. I mean, it's not as if there's not another position that can be taken, but this is the this is the position that's being taken over here. Yeah.
Sorry, you said that the reason in Hokin B'mamon Achar Roz is because of Hamotze Mechaveiro L'Varayu. Is that really?
Well, I did stick that in. Many say that. Now I'm not saying that. I'm sorry. Rashi says I'm not here. Oh, Rashi says right here. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm not sure. Going back.
No. Hold on one sec. So thank you. So let's just take a look at the top Rashi on the page. Ein Hokin B'mamon Achar Roz. Heicha de mistafakolon. Whenever we are mesubik, whenever there's a doubt to us, milsa kigon hacha, like in this case. So kigon, another example Rashi gives later on, hamocher shor lechaveiro. Right, we agree to sell that I'm going to sell you an ox. V'nimtza nagchon, and you purchase the ox, and then you realize that this ox is a shuramuad, it's a gurer, it's an animal that that is very dangerous and aggressive, and it's not the type of animal that I can leave and not have to worry about. So, lo amrinan basa ruba zil. We don't say, says the Gemara later on, that we follow the majority, and most people, when they purchase animals, they do so for the purpose of harisha. We don't say that. We say that maybe this guy, when I sold it to you, I thought maybe you just wanted an ox to eat. And so therefore, what do you care if it's an ox or not? I mean, you're gonna kill it tomorrow anyway. We don't say that. El amrinan, we say, hamotzi mechavero olavaraya. You want, now a different shor, you have to prove. The guy could say to you, I sold it to you shechita. Had you only said to me that you intend to use this for harisha, so then you'd have a case. But being that you didn't stipulate, I have a right to say, and even though, said the Gemara, the rove may be that people buy for the purpose of harisha.
Yeah, but however, that's different than the case.
It may be.
Between the chavis and the kaz. Because to my mind, in that case, you never really had a meeting of the minds in terms of what you're buying.
Right. Okay.
And so why...
You start off your question by saying how much of my father is right.
That's correct.
So let's get back, unless you have a different question. So,
no, but it's related to that.
I understand. So are the two related?
Back to the case.
So I think the two are related. Many say, and I don't know if anyone doesn't say, but many do say, enough say that I feel comfortably standing before you and saying that the underlying foundation upon which the principle of Ein Hochen B'Mamun Acha Rov is built upon is the principle of Hamotzi Mechaveiro L'Raya, which means I am a Muchzak. This is mine, and it's in my possession, and in order for you to now take that from me, to be forcibly taken from me in a legal way, so you have to have proof, and rov is not sufficient proof. You need either edim, you need a star, I mean, well, a star is not even going to work when it comes to metalpum, but you're going to need something which is going to prove that it's yours, and rov is not sufficient proof.
I'm making a distinction between the shor and the cotton. I'm just asking, why not break the sale and say we never had a meeting of the minds to begin with?
Because the mocha doesn't want to break the sale. He says, I got one less pit barrel I have to sell.
It's not equivalent to the shore, because we know what a shore is. In terms of what type of shore, that's arguable, and you could discuss it in this case. But in the case of the Clovis and the Cod, I came wanting to buy one thing.
Right.
You wanted to sell something else. We both use terminology.
But how do you...
And,
right, yeah, okay. So whose fault is it?
I don't think you should be able to apply this concept.
It's not a...
It's not a question of Hamotzi... it's not a great... I'm trying to...
I want to remind you that if you were a store owner and you would find yourself in this position and you would realize, Jeff, if you were a store owner and you would find yourself in this position, you would realize that honestly, there was an honest mistake over here. So needless to say, it would be a very proper thing to do, if not more than that. And the honest thing would be to say, you know, the truth is, there was a misunderstanding, and let's either agree on another price or go next door. That would be a nice thing to do, but that's not true. I don't know.
That's what you're saying.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm talking. They're in Besdin now. They're in Besdin. We're not talking about. If the dying would walk Rob out of the store and see two people arguing, so the dying may very likely say, "Listen, you know, give it back to him and fine." I mean, but if you're coming to Besdin and the guy's saying, "Excuse me, he owes me a chavish," and Besdin says, "What's your proof?" He says, "The proof is why I said a chavish," and then they say, "Well, you know what? In this place, not everybody calls a chavish." So then Besdin does not have the right. The Torah does not grant them the right to go ahead and take it from him. So we're not saying that this is the right. Just like, for example, Grumma Banezek, we've learned again and again is Pater. But yet, what we learn, that if you want to be Yotze B'dei Shemayim, you have to pay. That there are times that you have to pay B'dei Shemayim. Now, I'm not saying that's so here. But I'm not saying that the Torah is saying you should not give back the Chavis. You should teach him a lesson. How dare he walk into a store? No, that's not what we're saying. But we have a dispute here. And when all is said and done, someone's going to win and someone's going to lose. And the
process of a chavis and a kaz, when you walk into a store, you don't give the owner, the seller, the money until you have the merchandise,
right,
or at the very least that you see it. That's not a normal procedure. Nobody buys something and hands the money over.
The truth is, I gave that example. I don't know why I gave that example, because I just wanted to make it cleaner. But the truth is, not really what Rashi says. Rashi says his name, that there was a condition. I'm just hard, I have a hard time understanding the mechanics of that.
I can promise you, so you right. Probably paid for it, only then could you collect your stuff.
No, but what he's saying is that you could almost, I think what you're saying is you could blame the buyer a little bit also. He gave him his money before he saw it. Is that what you're saying? Right.
But I'm saying is, I'm also saying, you have to give him your money, there's no opinion there, and why should he take it?
Right. No, so that's that. We're not doing that. I mean, the answer is, if he would have given the money, then that would have constituted a kinyan. If he would have even given a little bit of money, the kinyan, there are different types of kinyanim. The fact that he agreed, so that's not going to be an all-out kinyan, but already that may be enough of an obligation that the two have to each other, that it's not so easy for either one to just walk away from the other at that point. Yes?
I want to make two observations based on what you
say. Okay.
One is that the Gemara seems to be saying that business is done based on conventions, and you have the responsibility to know the conventions that apply to the area of dealings or to the geographical place of dealings that you're in, so that when business is conducted, you can't challenge it just because you don't know how to do things over here. The other observation is that the Gemara seems to sort of be supporting the seller a little bit over the buyer, because each one has a claim. But the Gemara seems to be saying a deal is a deal, and it wasn't necessarily a fraud, it was just an interpretation that favored the seller. And you can't, you know, so
right.
Maybe the Gemara seems to be saying, in order for there to be a world of business and for people to make a living and for things to take place, we have to have a rule, and we're ruling this.
Right. I want to just point out to you, for those of you who feel that the most of us are put, and that's not necessarily going to make you feel better, but as being that we feel we're beating up in the left half so much, so Tosfos assumes, and many Rishonim will go along with him, and we're not learning this Tosfos tonight. There's no intent to learn it tonight, but we will get to it. But Tosfos learned the reverse would be true as well. Meaning that if the two agree on a price and he doesn't give him the money, Tosu says, and there was a Kenyan Suda, let's say, and now the Lokech is chayiv to give him the money, the Lokech could still say, I'm not going to give you the money until you give me what I had in mind. In other words, if there was, so, it's going to work both ways. In other words, the Lokech could also use this argument to hurt the Mocher. But the point is that both of them, whoever's the Muchzak, and that's the... I don't know, so we have to wait until we get there. But the idea, whoever the muhsak over here has, because that's always the key, whoever is the claimant has the disadvantage in this case, because the claim that he has is built on a rove, and that rove is not sufficient. What I would like to do, I intended to accomplish more tonight, but I'm fine, I'm fully satisfied, but I still would like to take a look at a Tosfos with you, get you to think about it a little bit, and we'll not be able to really deal with the issues that are introduced over here, but it will certainly give you more to think about over the week. And that is the top Tosfos on the next top, on Chav Zayin Amud Beis. Meaning, there is a big Tosfos over here, which we will ultimately dissect. But I want to start with the smaller one first. And Tosfos asked the question, and again, this is also by way of introduction, it's probably healthier to look at this first. And that is that, in general, in Halacha, we know that we do follow the rote. We do follow a majority. And not only do we follow a majority, let's say, in situations where my milk, I have some milk that falls into the challenge, and not only do we follow Rov in other situations of this or that there, we even follow Rov when it comes to Dina Nefashos. When it comes to issues of life and death, capital punishment, so then the Gemara in Sanhedrin teaches that we also follow the Rov over there. So Tosfos asks, Tema, Matam Ein Hochin, why do we say you don't follow the road by Mammon? Lacey b'kavachomer beginning of Fashos. Why not just say it's a kimsim b'kavachomer? Because the Gemara in the beginning of Sanhedrin says, then when it comes to Nefashos, we do. And the Gemara actually quotes an Amor over there, Rabbi Yoshia, who ma'isilei b'kavachomer says exactly this, midin and Nefashos. He says, umadin and Nefashos, b'chamiri, which is obviously more serious. You're dealing over here with loss of human life. It's obviously much more severe. And nevertheless, Amar Rahman, the Torah says, Zil Basaruba, you follow the majority, so Dini Mamunus, well, kosher case. So certainly when you're dealing with the Chavish, well, of course you should.
Could you give a case on how we do that, by the way?
How would that work?
Yeah.
Lots of situations that come up. So the one case is, I mean, it's rather complicated, but the case that Tosfos quotes over here in Sanhedrin, Daf Samach Tes, there's a case of Ben Sora Moreh, and deciding, the Gemara, as we know, paints a picture which makes it virtually impossible to person to actually be classified a Betzora Moda. And one of the qualifications, the Gemara basically sets it up that there's only a 3-month period in his life that a person could actually fit into that category. And the way it comes out is that it could be, depending on when he was born, that it could be that even less than that. So the Gemara says, why should we ever be able to kill a Ben Sora Mora? After all, maybe he's in that category. The Gemara says we follow the Rov. Most people, most women have full-term pregnancies, and therefore we assume that this guy is really a Ben Sora Mora. That's basically the upside of the Gemara. But what you see from there is that we would kill someone based on a Rov, based on the fact that most women have full-term pregnancies. I mean, that was the particular Rov over there. But there are other examples that are given. So Tosfos is just asking, why do we not say there should be a Kal Vachomer? If we follow Rov by Dinei Nefashos, we should certainly follow by Dinei Mamonos. So actually Tosfos in Sanhedrin asks this question and gives it an answer, and Tosfos here gives a different answer. This answer is...
So, Rabbi Yehoshua then disagreed with that principle of...
Right, Rabbi Yoshua rejects that. He says, he learns from a Kal Vachomer that's not true, that since the Torah tells us that we follow Rov by... By the way, where does the Torah tell us we follow Rov by... Dina Fashos? He says, the Torah tells us. Where's the Torah tell us? So the answer is that the source of Rov. Where's the source of Rov in Torah? It also says, Ra'os. The Ra'os, so Tosfos explains, implies death. And so therefore, the Torah tells us, the way Chazal understand Torah Shabbat Pan, the Torah teaches that we follow Rov by Nefashos. So why?
The other way around. In other words, we don't do it by...
But there you have the pasuk that says it. So
is it a
kosher pasuk? Yeah. Okay. So Tosa says Yeshlomar. Tosa says it's different. Hold on one second. One more piece. I didn't give you the Gemara Sanhedrin, so I just want to tell you one more thing. What is Rabbi Yoshi over there talking about? He's talking about what's the case of Rov that Rabbi Yoshi. He's discussing the following. He is saying, if you have, let's say, people come to Beis Din and they have a monetary dispute. So the din is that normally a Beis Din, for a din of mamash, you require 3 judges. So let's say 2 feel one way, and 1 dayan feels the other way. So what's the din? So we know the din is. The din is, the majority wins. Rav Yoshia disagrees. Rav Yoshia says that you shouldn't follow Rov. You shouldn't follow the Rov. Because after all, it's a Kal Vachomer. If the Torah says you don't follow the Rov by what? By Dinei Nefashos, Kal Vachomer, by Dinei Mamonos, you shouldn't follow the Rov. They should all... Forgive me. Rav Yoshia says we do follow the Rov. We also say follow the Rov. The question is, do you require more than one? So without getting into, again, the specifics of that sugya, the point is, Yoshia said you would follow the Rov. Why? Again, that Kal Vachomer, if you follow by Nefashos, so Kal Vachomer by Mamonos. So Tosfos says, why don't we apply that over here? Just say Kal Vachomer. So Tosfos says it's very different. Yishlom edahasim gabi dayonin, shiny. When you're dealing with judges, it's completely different. The chashiv miut didhu kamisha eino. Tosfos says when you have a group of judges that are judging a particular case, and they come to a conclusion, and some of them feel one way, and the majority feels one way, and the others feel differently. So the miut, the minority, is kamisha eino. It's like that. Literally, it's like that they don't exist. V'leka l'meima, you cannot say over there, uki mamona v'cheskas mari. In that case, you don't say, well, until all of them agree, this guy is going to hold on to his money. The habezdin makinine, because bezdin takes it from him. About Gabi Shar Mamon, but in all of the monetary cases like we have over here, a dispute between the buyer and the seller, the Ika Miut. You have on the one hand the minority of people who call Chavis Kad and Kad Chavis, and you also have the Chazaka, namely, this is my Chavis and you can't just take it from me. So then Lo Alid Azlina Basaruba. We don't follow the Rov. So Tosa says an interesting idea, which there are many, many different ways to explain, but Just we're not even going to begin to explain it now, but just again to repeat outside, and maybe you begin to digest this over the week, so you'll come in with some very fancy formulations as to what exactly this means. But Tosfos says, although it's true that our Gemara seems to be taking the position that Ein Holchin B'Mamon Achar Rov, that we do not follow the majority when it comes to monetary issues, Tosfos says when it comes to a disagreement between judges that are ruling in a particular case, so there the rule of Rove doesn't apply. Because the Dayanim that are overruled, it's like they don't exist. Kimisha Eino. And we do not take that minority and combine it with the Chazaka and say, unless all of the Dayanim agree, then we're not going to come to a conclusion. We don't say that to Tosfos over there. That's a different type of Rove, even though they're both Dinim Amanos. I mean, that's really the Chiddush when it comes. It's all talking about monetary issues. But Tosfos says the difference between Dayanim and a buyer and a seller. And what exactly that difference is and why there's a difference is not clear, or maybe it is clear to you, but I'll tell you there are many different ways that this Tosfos has been explained. So you'll think about it throughout the week. And I'll show you next week a very nice explanation that is offered. Okay. You don't have to have a cottage.